Well, to get kind of going, if you didn't pick up exams before, I got them up here and old papers and good stuff like that. So, remember the online quiz that went on Tuesday? When does it close? Friday or Saturday? Something like
Saturday.
That? Saturday. And then the three-point quiz closes? Is it also Saturday?
Yes.
Friday? I couldn't remember if I did it Friday or Saturday. But watch out for the closing times on the quizzes, right? The first quiz, I mean the one that went up on Tuesday, was that you could take as many times as you want. And then the three-pointer was one time through, but there's no time limit. So you can, like, you know, scour through your PowerPoints, textbook, whatever you want to get in there. I don't think it logs you out unless you sit for a long time or something on it, then it activates you. But don't, you know, let it sit overnight or something. So try to get those done. And then guess what happens at 10:30 today? Another quiz opens up, right? And how did I set that one up? I think that one's open for a long period too, right? Until like Sunday or something like that. But I think it's a one time through, right? But you got any all the time you want. So you could begin what the point is to begin to start to review. So it forces you to review through some of your notes. And that will cover some of the older material as well. All right, so look through the older material and, you know, get through that because it kind of goes over chapter 1, 3, 4, 5. It's a little bit of pieces all over, but it's just 10 questions. But everybody should make a 10 because it's not timed and you can take your time, doing the quiz, right? Because the main point is to try to learn it. Okay. So what are we doing today? We are finishing up digestion, and at 10:30, the other quiz opens up. You can start on it, but don't forget to take the other quizzes. And we'll probably be able to get through maybe even the heat and adaptations, and then what I'm hoping is that Tuesday is a review time for you. And then maybe we don't even have to have class on Thursday the following week if we spend time for review. Unless you want to have more time for review too, that's fine. So it's up to you. We can deal with that as we go along. But I think today we can pretty much wrap up some of the content. There's the first part on this in the GI. There's some really key elements that we should learn. And then the second part of this, the last PowerPoint, is kind of bigger picture, a few interesting aspects. And we'll go through that, okay? So check on things, make sure you can download stuff, and look at things. Alrighty. Let's look at the GI system. Sighting system, right? GI system. Okay, so what about your GI system? Interesting? We used to have a GI lab. Can you imagine? P lab and then the GI lab? Oh, no. It was not so bad. It was with crayfish. What you could actually do with the crayfish, it wasn't a human lab. What you could actually do with the crayfish is you could take a crayfish GI tract out. You know, it's very small, right? When you dissected those crayfish, it was on that ventral nerve cord. And you could actually put that on a little wooden dowel and you could, in little pieces, and you could watch it inchworm across the wooden dowel all by itself. Just drop saline on it. And then you could put serotonin on it. And you could watch it inchworm even faster. So it'd move along the dowel all by itself. It's like, whoa, that's just weird. Right? So it makes you think about the GI tract working independently of the rest of the body in that sense. And there's actually, in our GI tract, like a little nervous system we'll go over. And it's really interesting because you don't think about it, right? But your GI tract's working all the time. Autonomic system as well, parasympathetic, insympathetic. But we'll go through a little bit of those details. So it's really quite interesting. And as we mentioned last time, there's so much more on the gut-brain axis that's going on now because of the bacteria and factors that are released, right? And even bacteria that gets into our bloodstream and then affects our brain, and it affects the immune system. So what's in our GI tract can really affect your behavior, right? So it's really quite interesting. But let's just kind of cover it on a comparative aspect and make sure that we see some of the bigger pictures. It's really neat. You can look at what's the big picture? The GI tract is for what? We all know this, right? Put food in. Food just goes straight on through, right? We got to get nutrients out of there, right? But also waste products can be eliminated in the GI tract. So it's not just the food that goes through. We can actually get rid of substances as well. But what's the problem? If it goes through too fast, We don't get the nutrients, right? It goes too slow. Is that a problem? If it goes too slow? Possibly, right? There's actually some really neat data out there about the time that food stays in the human GI tract related with colon cancer and things like that. And they've actually looked at different cultures with different types of food and then separated out the genetic factors versus just the food. For example, they've looked at people living in the Gobi Desert area or Manchuria, the northern part of China, the part above North Korea, for example, and there's a lot of food where they eat kimchi, this fermented cabbage, which is, it has a lot of pepper in it and spices, red pepper. My wife eats this stuff. She loves it, but I can't eat it. It gives me a GI blowout, basically, so I can't digest my food. I think she tries to make me lose weight by this. But anyways, if that sits in your stomach for a long time, it actually, people that are used to it, it decreases the time that food, I mean, it increases the amount of time that food sits in your GI tract, and they've related that to increased colon cancer. So it's really quite interesting. The food that stays in there, the waste products can actually be somewhat dangerous. And then they looked at people that have moved in, you know, outside of that environment and changed diets, and they don't have the same problem. And then we know about our high-fat diet that we have in the Western world, pretty much. And then problems with high fructose, right, with that problem as well. So you can really pay attention to your diet. And there's some really interesting facts out there culturally and related with cancer aspects, but we don't have time to go through all that kind of stuff. But you think about then the general idea, get nutrients in, don't need to let it sit there too long, you have to expel it some way, right? And then animals that can expel it all the time versus storaging it and then getting rid of it. And it relates a lot with maybe what you've covered in ecology too. I don't know what they cover in ecology. Do they cover anything about like pooping? Nope. In animals and how they store it to not get out, let other animals know that they're there or anything. There's some really interesting facts around that. But anyways, okay, so you think about filter feeders, the simplest animals, right? Filtering in the seawater, a sponge, water just going on through, but you got to capture the nutrients. So how do you capture that? You know, like a little sieve, and what's good and what's not good. The sand might not be very good, but you want little bacteria that maybe you can break down. So it's really interesting how you think about how animals eat and capture their nutrients. All right, and then you think about other animals like a clam, you know, again, a filter feeder. But even the largest animals are filter feeders, like the whale, right, the baleen whale. And it's amazing, filtering that krill, just a small invertebrate crustacean. And, you know, think about the amount of krill that they have to capture to keep that body functioning, right? And that's a mammal, so a homeotherm. So it's a lot of food that they have to capture. And there, of course, worldwide, this is a problem because the krill are decreasing, so that means the whales don't have their food sources. But interesting, and then you get these nasty animals like mosquitoes that blood feed, really amazing things. And then, you know, animals that start to chunk on other animals and eat them up. And even like the crayfish, of course, we love that animal. Those little mouth parts are very strong on that animal. If you've ever held the crayfish, right, you might have the claws being held on one side, but your finger is by the mouth, you'll realize it can give you a nasty pinch with those mouth parts. It's very hard cuticle. And when these animals molt, for example, they eat their old cuticle to get their calcium back. But what you'll see in the tank, sometimes left over from the old exoskeleton, are the tips of the claws because they're really hard. And then the mouth parts, and they're just left in the tank because they don't eat them, and they're too hard maybe even to digest for that animal. So it's kind of interesting. And then we've talked about different ways of the claws, for example, too, the cutter and the crusher in like lobsters, but crayfish seem to be not asymmetric, pretty much symmetric on both sides. And then, of course, the other animals that can eat a whole animal like a snake, and they have such an amazing ability because they can, you know, displace their jaw and actually eat a large animal. And this relates to some really interesting studies that people have done with digestion in snakes, for example. You ever seen that on PBS Nature Show where they capture the big pythons in South America, how they capture them? It's really cool idea, and I don't think that people think about the digestive processes and that's going on. But they put these little wooden sticks down in a circle, and this might sound cruel, but then they put a little animal inside, like a little pig. And then they wait for the python to come in, and the python eats it, eats the whole thing, but it's so big in the stomach, it can't get out of the little sticks that they built as around the animal, so they know they can come back in a week or 2 weeks, and it's still going to be trapped in there somewhere down the GI tract. This pig is too big for it to get out the passageway. So it's kind of neat. I mean, so you think about different ways, and then simple ideas of how that works. And I think if you've had Jim Krupa, who's had Jim Krupa for evolution? Isn't he fantastic? He's fantastic. At least he probably showed you teeth. Did he show you teeth of different animals? No? Yes? Did he? No?
He did?
He did? He did? Okay, yeah, those are really cool because he gives you the different molars and incisors, and you have to think about, you know, what kind of animals that they probably ate. And just like us with our incisors and our molars. And you can look at the teeth structure and you can pretty much get an idea of what this animal probably eats, like a cow, you know, chewing back and forth, chewing their grass back and forth, versus canines that are going to bite you and tear apart meat, for example. And then, of course, I think you probably, you know, covered all this in probably evolution class too, about the beaks and the Darwin finches and issues around that, but really quite interesting about the kind of food that they eat as well as the structures to get that food. And then, of course, there's animals that can paralyze their prey. It's really amazing. This little, like this thing that would send out nematocyst and then paralyze it, and then it could digest it slowly. But you might have heard of cone snails. If you're out in like Malaysia or something, and you're scuba diving, or you're out in one of those trips, you know, where they tell you just go out and snorkel around, and then you're going to go pick up that little snail. Ooh, be very careful. The conotoxins in those snails are calcium channel blockers, and they can kill you with one sting. So just this little snail, and it's very toxic. So there's some really interesting animals out there that are so toxic with their, like nematocysts. Portuguese man-o-war, if you're ever swimming, and you get those like a jellyfish type, they can sting you enough that they can cause you to die as well. But the conotoxins from this little snail, they use it in neurobiology a lot to block calcium channels. So a lot of these animals with their toxins have been used, like TTX and the pufferfish, right? They use them to block voltage-gated sodium channels. So they've really been helpful to understand how we function and do things, but how they work in the animal. And then you think about, well, if they just stung that animal with this deadly conotoxin that blocks voltage-gated calcium channels, and then they eat it, how come they don't die from it, right? Interesting ideas? What do you think? Maybe different isoforms of the calcium channel that's not sensitive to that. So you think, oh, wow, that's really cool. Or maybe the digestive enzymes in that animal will break it down. So lots of interesting aspects that people have studied with this. So as we just mentioned, the time of digestion, right? Low quality food, you're going to have to take a longer time to get the nutrients out. High quality food, you can digest quickly and get the nutrients out. So that kind of diet makes a difference as well. But this goes in context. You have to kind of think about roughage as well. Goes through a lot faster than something that would be packed in your body. But when you think about the time of digestion, like we mentioned with heterotherms versus homeotherms, heterotherms are dependent on that environmental temperature to help. And then if we just think about mammals, right, we've talked about the metabolism to keep your body temperature high, right, at a set point. So does the elephant have a higher metabolism or the little mouse, right, at homeotherms per gram, right? Remember this way back when, chapter 3, I think it was, or chapter 1? Because you have a larger surface area to bottle volume, right? So you dissipate that heat a lot easier for the small animal surface-to-volume ratio versus the large elephant. Right, it has a lower surface area to volume ratio. So the metabolism for these small animals to keep that body temperature, they have to eat all the time. So if they have to eat all the time, they don't have time to do other things, right? And they have to worry about predation all the time. But it's kind of interesting, the same kind of idea here about food coming through and the quality of food. So a cow eating grass, for example. All right, we just talked about snakes with body temperature, same idea. Reptiles, heterotherms, takes a longer time for them to digest. Okay, so the general idea through all the digestive systems and the animals, basically get that food in, right? And where does digestion start in us, for example? It's been a question on standardized exams, too. They have like the mouth, the stomach, you know, small intestine, but the mouth, right? Because you're already crunching it up. And you're breaking that up, so that's a part of the digestion. And the salivary glands dumping out saliva. And so you're at, and there's enzymes in that saliva that helps to start breaking down the food. Amylase, for one thing. And so digestion starts in the mouth, and there's so many different aspects out there with the different animals, like the birds. You've probably heard about gizzards and the birds, right? They actually swallow little stones, and it helps grind up the food in their stomach, too. So that's kind of interesting that they actually eat stones. And so if you raise chickens, anybody raise chickens? Raise chickens? No one raised chickens around here? It's kind of a big thing nowadays, right? Raise your own chickens. And yeah, right? Do you feed them little gravel? Do they? Can they peck?
I live on a 10-acre farm.
Oh, so they can go everywhere. Okay. But some people put them in cages and they don't give them the whole aspects that they really need, too, like little stones that they'll peck and swallow them to help in their digestive processes. So it's really quite interesting when you look across different animals. So basically, bring food in, start the digestion, start to break it up if their teeth are rocks in there. And then, what do you want to do? So that breaks it down somewhat, but doesn't break it down all the way. But the best way to break down the rest of the food is to have a very acidic environment and enzymes, right? But enzymes, as we know from chapter, 3, they function differently in different environments, right? So you have enzymes that will work in a basic environment, like in our saliva, but those enzymes, like amylase, when it ends up in our stomach in an acidic environment, what's going to happen to that amylase? It's going to be broken down, right? And so then you have that very acidic environment, like a pH of 2, and then that's going, and that's, what if you had that pH of 2? Do you want that next to your the cells in your stomach? Because that's going to start digesting the cells, right? And the proteins on those cells. So you don't want, it's not a spot for absorption, right? It's just a spot for a digestion. So we've mentioned this before. There's a mucus lining that's released from goblet cells that causes mucus to be released in the stomach, coats that environment. But after finals, some of you are going to drink too much or maybe hard alcohol. What's that going to do to that mucus lining? Dissolve it, take it away. Right, so then you eat the food, like the hamburger at the sports bar, with the alcohol, and you've taken away the mucus lining. So now, that acidic environment does what? It hits your cells, and then you keep doing that, you're going to get an ulcer, and it's going to end up like a bleeding ulcer. And so this is why alcoholics, for one reason, have bleeding ulcers. So not good. It's moderation for everything, right? All right, so that's kind of interesting to think about. And then, if those enzymes are chewing up in an acidic environment, you need enzymes that can handle that acidic environment, right? So they have a structure that's strong enough to be able to handle that low pH and help to break some of that food down. But then you want to be able to absorb that. So now dump that food into another part of your GI tract, the small intestine, and now that's going to be the area for a lot of absorption. But you don't want an acidic environment, so now you neutralize it. So how do you neutralize it? You change that environment. So you secrete pancreatic enzymes, the gallbladder, with bile salts, for example, that are from the liver, stored in the gallbladder, dumped out into the small intestine, along with pancreatic enzymes, and it then becomes neutralized. So now you want that food to be able to touch the cell membranes so that it can absorb the nutrients. And so now that environment is a different environment than in the stomach. You need all that absorption and assimilation. Bring that in. And then, so you're not pooping all the time, leaving a trail for predators to follow you or gross you out. You can store that, right? And then expel it when you need to. And if you covered this in ecology, it's kind of interesting about different animals, how they might release their contents, their waste products at different times, depending on environment or predation, for example, because they don't want to give out signals to other animals. Okay, so that's the basic elements of the GI tract. It's really interesting on a comparative basis if you look through GI tracts, and I don't want you to have to memorize all these different names. It's just too much. You can always look this stuff up. But the main idea that we talked about, Malpighian tubules, for example, in insects, that aid in renal function, right? Basically ion balance, water balance, and that dump the contents from taking in waste products or excess water into the GI tract, right? Malpighian tubules are like the renal system in us, basically control ion balance and can dump it in the GI tract. So really kind of interesting. If we look at these different animals, let's go over here. This is quite neat because in embryology, embryology would be a great course. We don't have it, but you can actually go online and actually sign up for online courses at different places if you're really interested, like an embryology course. How that GI tract forms from the early development, and then from that GI tract, you get the liver, the pancreas, and different secretory glands that come off of that developing GI tract. And so this is why you see everything associated, these other organs associated with the GI tract, like the liver and the pancreas. Really quite neat. Here in this rabbit, for example, this large structure right here, the cecum, is like the... oh my gosh. I'm forgetting the word of it. What's the thing that you have? The
appendix.
Appendix, yes, thank you. The appendix. And you have appendicitis, right? Anybody ever hear of anybody have appendicitis? Yes, very painful. And you can do what if you have appendicitis and don't go to the hospital?
Appendectomy.
You can get an appendectomy, get it taken out. But if you didn't get to the hospital, what happens?
Ruptures,
and you go underground, right? And feed the worms. All right, so another thing to digest you. But the thing is that's really bad, right? If appendicitis busts, because that's your bacteria that's inside your GI tract and it gets into your body and septicemia, and then you go. And think about before they knew that was a problem, right? And what if you're in the rural area and you don't get to the dock, or you're way out somewhere and that happens, that's it, right? So it's really quite interesting. But then look at the rabbit. This one is gigantic. So this is basically the appendix in the rabbit. And it's between the small intestine, large intestines. We have a very small one. Where is it? Yeah, right there, that little thing. And they realize that there's part of the appendix actually has a function with the immune system. That's pretty cool. And in other animals, they realize this packages up with some of the poop, too, and actually stores some of the bacteria. So it can actually re-inoculate the GI tract as well. Really quite interesting. And you think about life-threatening problems with humans when we have appendicitis. And if you ever talk to some GI people or surgeons, they say they find the craziest things that might have caused appendicitis. Toothbrush bristles, for example. Toothpicks that they swallowed by accident. Little things, toys sometimes get stuck in there. And then it has a problem. So really kind of interesting are other factors as well. So really quite neat on a comparative aspect. But so I don't want you to memorize all these different structures and where they are, but the idea of this developmental pattern is really quite interesting. It's all this one tube, and then these structures come off of it, like the liver, pancreas, appendix, and all function to help with digestion. But there's such an interesting comparative nature when you go across the animal kingdom. And even, look at, in this sense, the amphibians, you actually see like the kidney and ureter here in the fish and the reptile. And then you see us that we're separated out for our renal function, just like the fish is. But the other animals, like we talked about, uric acid being secreted in the bird poop, and then the urine that comes from that, right? And it's all out the GI system. So kind of interesting where you see this separate. And there's lots of issues. If you get online, you can actually see developmental issues in things like some kids that are born, the newborn that doesn't have an anus, for example, the hole didn't open, they have to go into surgery quickly, or they actually, the urethra didn't form, and they can't pee, and so they have to go into surgery. So this is why that neonatal doc is really important. The neonatal doc checks the kid out quickly right after birth, and checks to make sure things are working right. But prenatal care is so important, because with ultrasound now, they can do so much to make sure everything's developing correctly. So they, if not, then they know what to do right during birth. So really quite interesting. Well, let's look at the stomach, for example, like us, our stomach, and what's happening there. So you see the esophagus, food going down, right, after it's gone through your mouth, down the esophagus, and then into your stomach. So you don't really have a valve. It's just a sphincter that kind of closes and opens up, right? And the food goes in, and then we're going to start with the digestion process. We've already started in the mouth, but continue with the digestion process in the stomach. So what's happening in the stomach? The acidic environment, enzymes, and then it's moving around, but it's not really breaking the food up that much in little pieces like we will see as we go into the GI, the intestine. But what happens in that region is really quite interesting with the acid secretion. And you've probably heard of people saying they have heartburn, right? What's the heartburn really? It's reflux, right? A reflux of the acid environment going up in the esophagus because it's right there and it feels like it's your heart, right? So it's not really heartburn, but it's the esophagus reflux. So what happens if you keep refluxing that acidic environment in your esophagus? What's going to happen to those cells? Yeah, an ulcer. They're going to get damaged, right? Because that acidic environment, they're not used to it. But guess what? They actually call this a certain syndrome, and I don't want you to memorize things, but actually they're more susceptible with heartburn if you continuously have that, like eating kimchi or something, I would, is that you get the cells that get damaged. And if they're continually getting damaged, they could bleed, but not only that, increase the likelihood of cancer. So they now know that that's a very likelihood of increasing cancer with the continual irritation of acid reflux in the esophagus. So really quite interesting to think about. Okay, then we look at the structures here down deep. And if you ever go into and you're rotating around with somebody that does endoscopic work, really neat, if you get a rotation, if you're in allied health, and they actually then scope somebody, get down to the GI tract, they're looking for the ulcer, they can tell an alcoholic right away. It's basically smooth, it doesn't have all the roughage in there, and that mucus layer is gone because of chronic alcoholism. But then they can see multiple little blood vessel breakups and tissues that it's damaged. But if you look at inside these regions here, for example, you get these different cells, that these main three types of cells, there's other ones there too, but these main three we should know. The goblet cells for mucus secretion, parietal cells, and chief cells. And these appear on standardized exams too. But what do these cells do? Goblet cells are mentioned? Mucus, right? So think of a goblet, you know, maybe a goblet, you're drinking something. All right, and then parietal cells and chief cells. How to remember what these do? Well, chief cells, think of a chief sitting in a, I don't know, you know, chief, right? And then having a Pepsi, right, with his tribe or whatever. I don't know if that's culturally not right or something. But anyway, so, you know, having a Pepsi, right? And the chief's having a Pepsi. All right, so that's pepsinogen. And then the parietal cells, you can think of as parents, and maybe they're toxic to you, you know, acid, environment, it depends. So parietal cells, HCL. I'm just trying to think of ways that you can remember this if you're taking standardized exams or your final exam in here. Okay, so let's look at these a little bit. Whoops, we'll go. I think we have them coming up here later. No, maybe not. Okay. Well, I'll just mention it again. All right, so we'll go back to this. It's in your books. So goblet cells, mucus, parietal cells, HCl, you know, hydrogen ions, chloride, which is hydrochloric acid, right, HCl. Chief cells, pepsinogen, and we'll talk about pepsinogen in a little bit. But pepsinogen is not active itself, but pepsinogen is broken down to pepsin by HCl. So these cells working together. So chief cells release the pepsinogen, parietal cells the HCl, converts pepsinogen to pepsin, and I think there's a PowerPoint coming up with that. And then that pepsin works on the proteins and starts breaking down certain proteins. Okay. If we think about a little bit of a different type of stomach, like in a cow, which is a ruminant, right? They have four stomachs. You've probably heard of animals with four stomachs. So, and if anybody's in ag biotech or taking courses over there, they spend a lot more time on ag biotech, right? And all the details about the four different stomachs and how they work. And if you go over to the animal farm that's north of town, they have a cow with a hole in it, right? And actually you can open it up. They can put food in different regions. Did you ever try it? You stuck your hand in. Isn't that cool? It's cool, right? And then you can put different types of food in there, and you can take it out, and you can see how the animal's breaking it down. And if you've ever raised cattle, they'll eat the grass, for example, and what do?
Ruminate.
They can cough it back up, right? And they re-chew it again, and that's called chewing your cud, right, for a cow. But that shows you that it's continually helping to break it down. So they can chew it with their teeth, goes back to the stomach, this first part of the stomach. So, and if they're going to cough it back up, is this going to be an acidic environment, do you think? No. So it makes sense. This is not an acidic environment. But it's beginning to break it down, to ferment this, right? Bacteria. And they cough it back up, chew it again, swallow it back down. I know that might sound gross. But anyways, then they do that. And now they can dump it from these stomachs into the true stomach, which is more of an acidic environment. And they're not going to be coughing that place, that food back up, because that would damage their esophagus. So it fits pretty nice. I don't want you to have to memorize the different names here, but you probably would if you took the animal science course. But the idea is fermentation in this first place, and then the true stomach for acidic environment and breaking down more of the contents with the acidic environment. And then a lot of, you've probably heard it in the news too, the CO2 that's produced from the bacteria that's produced when the cows cough it back up are actually let out gas from their GI tract as well. Okay. If we look at the intestine region, it's really quite amazing where that assimilation is going to happen and absorption of food. What do you have to have? You have to have absorb it into the bloodstream, right? So it's got very vascularized tissue. And arterial supply and venous fluid coming out. But also, don't forget about the lymphatic system. Lymphatic system is heavily involved in their GI tract and in the intestine, and in the large intestine as well. So generally, in most of them, even the crayfish intestine is like this. There's circular muscles that contract down like that, and then there's longitudinal muscles that contract the tube long ways, right, and shorten it. So circular muscles and longitudinal muscles. What's really kind of cool is this is smooth muscles, right? In mammals, these are smooth muscles. So everybody thinks, oh, GI tract is all smooth muscle. But in some crustaceans, it actually looks like skeletal muscle. It has that nice sarcomere banding pattern that you hated on the exams to take, right? But so they actually have a skeletal muscle for their GI tract. Kind of interesting. All right, so we look at these muscles and we see how they function. You can hear them, right? And if anybody's in healthcare, you know, like after anesthesia or after surgery, they're going to listen to your stomach to make sure that you have stomach sounds, that your digestion's coming back, right? And that tells that the anesthesia is coming off, and that sometimes, like if you have a baby, for example, or a C-section, for mothers in the group, later future mothers, they'll wait to actually hear that you've actually passed gas. I know that might sound weird, but they'll actually make sure that you have GI function. And that's important because they don't want the GI tract to stay still. And sometimes you get paralytic GI tract where it doesn't move. And what happens then? It builds up, right? And it can clog because the small intestines is all circled around in you, right? About 21 feet of it in you. And so if that builds up, it makes a kink, and then food can't go out, what can happen? Can break, right? Or if it gets twisted, like in delivery, then that can actually twist it, and the blood supply doesn't get to that tissue. So what's going to happen if the blood supply doesn't get to it? The tissue dies, right? And that's really life-threatening as well. So they have to go in and remove that part of the GI tract. You remember MASH, the movie MASH? Is that a generation gap or something? MASH, you know, the series MASH, right? Alan, the guy that's in there, the doc that's in there, right, that wrote the movie itself, he was somewhere in Machu Picchu, right, in Peru, and he had a GI tract that wasn't moving, and he actually had a problem, and he had to have surgery in a little remote village by a kind of a country doc, if you will, and he realized, it's kind of an interesting story, that you know, he was hoping that everything's going to be done right, but it was so serious that he had to have the surgery right away. So he had this done, had a part of his GI tract removed, and he realized that the surgeon wasn't communicating in English, but it was by hand signs and drawing out a figure to explain the surgery to him. And he realized how important communication is. So when he came back to the States, he actually opened up a program to aid students in communicating their ideas, for people to communicate well in different forms of communication. So you can look up at Allen Communication. They'll actually give you grants to, and you can participate in that as well. But you see the power of that communication and drawing the figures and understanding it to somebody was really important. So it's kind of neat to put things, I know a tangent, but it pulls it all together so you remember. All right. So if we look a little bit more detail in this tissue right here, and you look really more into it, you see this these little fingers that are sticking out. And on every one of these little fingers right here, these villi, little fingers, these villi, it's a tremendous amount of surface area, right? If you can have these infoldings, it's like in our brain, and you have these infoldings, and then again, these little villi, fingers coming off, but then you look at one of those little villi, and look what's happening there. You got all these cells, and this is a good point right here to see the blood supply. You get the red is the artery, the blue is the veins, right? And this green is your lymphatic system. So central lateral is where excess fluid can come in, but also very important for fat. We'll see in a minute. Okay. But then look at that cell right there, and if you look at the top of that cell, the surface of the cell, the individual cell, look what you get on top of that. More little fingers. So it's like your GI tract has a hand, right? And then you think of those fingers, the villi, and then you take those villi, that one, and now you put another hand on there, and now you have all those, and then on top of those individual cells on that one, then you have an increased surface area again. So it's like, wow, think how big that surface area just increased by having all those infoldings and these little fingers that keep coming out. So now you have this great surface area right there, okay? And this is what then takes in the nutrients. And to take in nutrients, what do you need? You're going to need ATP, energy-demanding process. So they have a lot of mitochondria. So let's look at how some of this works. Okay. And then on top of those little fingers that are on the fingers that are on the fingers, you have a glycolytic enzymes and sugars and all this good stuff to try to get the nutrients in. There's a nice little picture. All right, so some more pictures. And you can just see that you need tissues that are going to secrete out mucus and enzymes. And so we'll go into a little bit of that too. So you don't have to memorize these different layers. Don't worry about that. It's just too much information. The main point, okay? And then digestion that we think of, breaking the food down into particles. And this is very important, the segmentation of the food. Break it down to smaller and smaller parts. And then we can pack it later on in the large intestine. If you look at your activity, or you hear it, for example, you hear the stomach, the intestine moving, but if you actually record it from the cells, you'll see this kind of activity, basal activity that goes on, and then every once in a while those muscle cells will spike, and that's when you have a really strong contraction. So you have this basal activity, and let's see, I think there's a, yeah, here's a good picture for that. And the stomach, the activity that you see, basically, don't worry about the potential sizes, it's just the idea that the muscle depolarizes and then contracts, right? Especially if you're talking about smooth muscle, remember multi-unit, single unit, remember all that? And then you think of the small intestine as a much higher rhythm, right? Because what are you doing? You're segmenting that food and you want it to mix with the surface of the cells. And the colon, you're basically packing it in, and then the final kind of tweaking of the food, like getting out excess water, for example. All right, so let's go back over here. If we look at the nervous system in the intestine, like I said, it's like its own little system working by itself. You don't have to memorize the different aspects of this, but there's this myenteric plexus. And if you remember way back when we talked about the sympathetic and parasympathetic, I mentioned one other type of nervous system that goes along with the autonomic that you sometimes hear, mostly like in Eastern Europe, or some older textbooks called the metasympathetic, because they sometimes define the nervous system with the GI tract being a separate system. And this is why. But it's connected in with the systems that we think of generally. Right? The vagal nerve comes in. It's going to work on this. And what does it do generally parasympathetic to contraction rate? Is it going to increase it or decrease it? Increase it. So it can actually keep that peristalsis going and get digestion, right? And the sympathetic will generally decrease it. But Under severe cases, you can have a GI blowout when you get super scared, right? And so that could be from the sympathetic system if sometimes. So there's this kind of exception. But in general, normal digestion. Parasympathetic increases the GI movement to aid in absorption, and the sympathetic slows it down. All right, so remember the neurotransmitters involved? What are the neurotransmitters for parasympathetic? Nicotinic, right? Sympathetic, nicotinic, epinephrine, norepinephrine, right? So you put that together with this. But then these can function to actually work on endocrine cells, and we'll talk about the endocrine hormones that are released in the GI tract in a minute. So just that you take home that there is this neural plexus that's inside your GI tract, helps with this smooth muscle contraction, longitudinal and circular muscle, and aid in contraction. So here we go. Epinephrine put on there decreases movement, and acetylcholine speeds it up, parasympathetic. And in other animals, like we mentioned, the crayfish, for example, you can put serotonin on it, and you can just watch it contract. And same with other insects, Okay. So let's go through some of these parts, some of the nitty-gritties. In the salivary gland, you release amylase, which helps break down substances. Also, there's thought that it actually can add into aiding to break down foreign substances, maybe even viruses, so that's kind of interesting as well. But then you secrete quite a bit of saliva, right? And you're swallowing it, and then you reabsorb that in your GI tract. So here's, sometimes it's appeared on tricky questions, not in our class, but on other tricky questions, about saliva, you know, the food you eat is absorption, right? The saliva is reabsorption, because it's, you already had it in your body, right? And then you reabsorb. But saliva is very important. What happens when you get sick and you're going to upchuck? Generally, you can tell that right away that you better be running to the sink or to the toilet, right? Because all that saliva is coming up in your mouth. Isn't that amazing? You didn't have to think about it. It just happens. But think about how that's coordinated. And people actually try to study that. How is that coordinated before you throw up, that you will actually push out all that saliva and then the stomach contents comes up, but it's to help protect the mouth, right? So it doesn't have that acidic environment. So it's kind of interesting to think about. All right. And then this is basically a kind of a basic solution, bicarb, and you have a lot of salts in there, and that saliva, then you swallow it with your digestive foods. Right? And this is kind of interesting because saliva adds for lots of things, not just for adding for digestion, but in some animals, they actually put saliva onto their body to help cool them, like evaporative cooling. So saliva could act as a cooling agent for thermal regulation as well. Really quite neat. Or you've probably seen, it's really gross, those turkey buzzards, right? When they go down and eat some roadkill that's on the road, they actually vomit on it. And they just sit there, and then they re-eat it. And you think, what on earth are they doing that for? Some people think that actually aids in the digestive process. Other people think it's actually to keep away other animals from eating that food, because another animal wouldn't want to eat it if it had that kind. But you think it's roadkill anyways, and it's probably nasty smelling already. But there's some interesting aspects to that, why animals would actually vomit and then eat it. Okay. Okay, there's so many weird things up there. Generally, then, the different regions kind of get the idea of what's going on, particularly the pH. So the most acidic environment is the stomach, right? Very acidic. And we're going to talk about this composition in the stomach. But things that we should remember is right, is over here on this side. Amylase and bicarb, basic environment for saliva. When you get in the stomach, we talked about pepsinogen from what cells? Just having a cold. Who has a coat? Chief cells, right? And then HCl from parietal cells. And then we're going to talk about intrinsic factor, which is really important. So intrinsic factor is released here. It goes into your stomach contents, and it actually aids in vitamin B complex absorption in your small intestine. So an alcoholic that's damaging these cells, for example, might not make intrinsic factor, or those cells are damaged. And so what's going to happen to the vitamin B complex in these people? They're not going to get the vitamin B complex. Some people have a genetic link or some problems. They don't make intrinsic factor. And if they don't make intrinsic factor, then they can't absorb the B complex vitamins. So they might actually get shots of intrinsic factor or have to take it exogenously. But then they wonder, is it, if you had a vitamin B complex deficiency, which some people have, is it because you don't make intrinsic factor, or is it because you don't, you're not eating the B complex vitamins, or is it the absorption of the B complex from the small intestine? So they actually have to work that out by giving B vitamins an intrinsic factor, and then if you still can't get it in your blood, then you realize it's an absorption problem. If they just give intrinsic factor and things work, then you know it's a lack of the intrinsic factor. All right? So it's really quite interesting, and there's some really important relationships with this. What does the B complex do for us? B12, for example. Where do you use B12? B12? Okay, maybe we didn't hit that before. B12 is useful and it's necessary for making red blood cells. So, do you have anemia due to a dietary deficiency, not of iron, but maybe of the B complex vitamins? Or do you have an anemia because you're not making intrinsic factor? Or do you have anemia because you don't have the absorption? Or do you have anemia because you're an alcoholic and you damage your cells to make intrinsic factor? You see what I mean? Or you're an alcoholic that's having a bleeding ulcer and you're getting blood out into your GI tract and you're losing blood that way. So you see, it's really quite interesting, all these different aspects. It's really quite cool. All right? And then we'll talk a little bit about bile and the enzymes that are released in the duodenum and small intestine. There's a lot of different enzymes. The main ones that we have to remember for class, but you can always look up more things, is amylase in the mouth and saliva, pepsinogen in the stomach, and then the pancreas. There's a whole bunch of enzymes in the pancreas that actually help, and that's that pancreatic juice that we mentioned that's dumped from the pancreas into the small intestine and then aids in that digestive process. And they break down the proteins and starch and triglycerides. Lipase is really important also, right? And then these other enzymes that are released in the small intestine that then, like we showed, that dumped out into the small intestine.
Do you want us to know what, like, breaks down?
No. You don't have to know what it breaks down, just that these enzymes are there and that you get the general idea of breaking down the food products into smaller. Some of these enzymes are very specific. They'll only break particularly between two amino acids. Others are not as specific and they'll kind of break down multiple bonds between multiple types of amino acids. In biochemistry, maybe you've covered that. Do you cover that in biochem? Right? So the general idea here, and biochem can tell you more about specific amino acid linkage for breaking down these particular peptides. Okay, and we've talked about glycogen before. Very important to break it down. Cellulose is harder to break down, and this is, you know, chewing it multiple times, like the cattle plant material has a lot of cellulose too, so it's hard to break it down. Starch, right? So this is why digestion, chewing it, breaking it into small molecules as possible, and then giving it an acidic environment. So the main hormones, we covered a little bit of endocrine in there before, but the main hormones now with the GI tract. And I just heard the other animal physiology class didn't even cover endocrine at all. They skipped the whole endocrine section. Wow. Okay, I feel sorry for anybody in that class that's taking MCAT because they're going to have hormones on there. Okay, so the hormones that we should relate with this chapter in the GI aspect is gastrin. We're going to talk about gastrin. And this is released in the stomach, and it helps to produce HCl from which type of cells? Parietal cells, right. Okay. And then CCK and secretin are two other main hormones that we should know. And these are from the small intestine. I don't want you to have to break up the small intestine to knowing the different aspects of duodenum and jejunum and all the different things. Just small intestine as a whole, okay? There's just too much stuff. But these two hormones we should know, CCK and secretin, because they work really importantly. The CCK, or abbreviated cholecystokinin, the CCK, works in the gallbladder and the pancreas. secretin works on the pancreas primarily. But these two hormones are kind of interesting in the endocrine world. Because if you look at the pancreas itself, and you look at, you know, it's going to contract and release this pancreatic juices. If you put CCK on, it does a little bit. You put secretin on, it does a little bit. You put the two hormones together, and you get a greater than additive effect. So this is used as an example as synergistic effect. When you hear synergistic, it's greater than additive. This has appeared on standardized exams before, these two enzymes, as an example of a synergistic effect of two hormones. They work better than just an additive effect. Okay, so CCK and secretin. These other hormones, they're important, but we're not going to go through and memorize. What's really interesting, too, is all these GI hormones that we just see on this table, they're also found in the brain. And people don't know what they're doing in the brain. But they were given these names because they were first identified in the GI tract. So there's still a lot of information out there to try to figure out what they're doing in other parts of the body. All right? So hopefully that kind of speeds it up. If we talk about how these parietal cells release hydrogen into the lumen of the stomach, again, we see this carbonic anhydrase is key here, and then that's going to work on, this gastrin actually works on these cells to increase the HCl secretion. So don't try to memorize the different, you know, parts here like we did in the renal system, but at least that you understand there's a hydrogen pump that will pump hydrogen into the stomach. All right, and so this is the figure I was looking for earlier. Parietal cells with HCl, chief cells with pepsinogen, pepsinogen broken down to pepsin by HCl, and then that pepsin can work on proteins to break down those peptides. What's not shown here are the goblet cells that then would release the mucus to protect the lumen lining. Okay. So when you think about these hormones, this has confused people over the years sometimes because they think these hormones are released into the GI tract and mixed with the food and then works on the cells. Where are they released? Into it. The bloodstream, right? So they're released from the bloodstream. And if you look, which this text and the other text doesn't go into, it's really quite interesting because how are you going to get the blood coming from, or how are you going to get this hormone coming from the small intestine to then go to the pancreas or the gallbladder? You don't want it dumping in the systemic circulation being diluted out, right? So think of the blood supply that comes through here after it picks up these hormones. Boom, then it goes to those tissues. What does that kind of remind you of? And charades? No. Hypothalamus, bloodstream, right? Releasing hormones onto the anterior pituitary, right next. It's pretty cool, isn't it? It's pretty cool. So if you look at the blood supply on the stomach, it's really quite neat in the way that it keeps a high concentration of these hormones going right to the next tissue from where they're released, not dumped into the lumen of the GI tract. All right? They're really cool. Okay, Pavlov's experiments, you've probably heard of those, right? Very important. Does anybody take freshman psychology 101? Good class to take. You can do it online even if you want, right? Good thing. And then take developmental psych right after that because that's really good to take as well. Really amazingly stereotypic kind of different behaviors and psychology that goes on with different age groups as well. But Pavlov's experiments, in case you haven't heard that, right? What he did is he would feed dogs with a bell, you know, right? Bell. And then they'd get their food. And then he kept associative learning going on that way. And then he could just ring the bell and the dogs think they're going to get their food, right? So what did he study by this? He studied that, the associative learning, but then they just ring the bell that dogs would already have gastric secretions going on and their stomach would already be releasing the HCl and pepsinogen. So they realized, wow, this associative learning is really powerful for getting ready for the food to get into the stomach. And that relates to us, right? You go buy Burger King, you smell those Whoppers cooking, it's like already started, just going, you had to turn off and go into there. And so it's really quite interesting, this Pavlov's experiments. It was very important because then he could understand the different aspects of digestion, for example. This is the cephalic phase, right? You're thinking about it, your brain is thinking about that food, you smell it, and you don't have to think, I need to secrete juices, right? It just happens. So this kind of part of the digestive process that can break these down into different regions, but this is what's on standardized exams sometimes as an example of a cephalic phase of digestion, that you see the food, you smell the food, it can cause your stomach to start secreting these enzymes and HDL to rise. And if you don't get the food, then what happens? That HDL is building up in there, right? So it's kind of not so great all the time to drive by Wendy's or Burger King. Okay, so if you think about these in the small intestine, how do you get all that nutrient across, right? It's kind of like what we talked about before in the renal system, too. When you look at this, it's really amazing, but this is just a generalized. There's many more things to it. But what's driving all these nutrients to come across from the lumen of the small intestine into the cell and then into the bloodstream? What's the driving gradient here? Our wonderful pump again, right? Sodium-potassium pump. Isn't that amazing? This is just everywhere and so important. Because what does it do? It sets up the driving gradient. It pumps sodium out. And then you see like co-transporters, glucose with sodium, amino acids with sodium, other factors with sodium. But that sodium gradient is really driving this. So this is what's referred to as what? Secondary active transport. This is a review for your final, right? Kind of think, hint. Okay, get the idea. All right, so these things that we remembered went over a long time ago, we'd have to come back and think about. Bile salt, fat, how do we absorb fat? We want fat in our body. We need it. It's, you know, cholesterol's, right? The backbone of hormones, really important. Aldosterone, backbone of aldosterone as well, right? But how do you get that into your body? So it was very confusing for a long time. People didn't understand how free fatty acids got into your bloodstream, or really into your lymphatics, which then got into your bloodstream. But this diagram right here was awarded basically a Nobel Prize by the people at Southwestern in Dallas, Texas. Southwestern Medical School, I mentioned before, is really a phenomenal medical school, but it's in Dallas. That's the bad part. But they actually had five Nobel laureates on their faculty. Wow. It's the only med school in North America with that many Nobel laureates on their faculty. But they've worked out the digestive processes of fat. Basically found out that bile salts break them down and then attach to those microvilli that we talked about in the cells. It's taken in, goes into the endoplasmic reticulum, and then it's actually with the Golgi complex made into these things called chylomicrons, like little vesicles. Those little vesicles then are released into the lymphatic system. And they can then travel in the lymphatic system, and then remember the lymphatic system is dumped into the bloodstream, right? So it's really quite amazing. People didn't understand this process, and it's more detailed than what's shown here, but the idea of it going into the cell, working with the Golgi, making these chylomicrons, in case you hear chylomicrons again, and then the chylomicrons dumped into the lymphatic system and then into the circulatory system. Okay, when we think about, I know this is just lots of different things, and I know it's kind of schizophrenic in a sense, but it's a lot to it. I'm just trying to hit the main things. When you think about that fluid going in, right? We don't want it all, you know, whatever you drink, like the water, the coffee, that doesn't come out in the poop, right? In the feces. You absorb that. So where are the different regions that you absorb most of the liquids? A lot in the small intestine. So if you look at how much, say, you're making, and we just talked about salivary glands, that adds a lot of fluid, all that being released into the stomach, the mucus, the enzymes that are released, the bile, fluid, the pancreatic juices, all that's adding to the fluid in the small intestine. But look, you reabsorb that, basically, in addition to whatever you're drinking, and in the small intestine. But the large intestine can be that final tweaker. If you're dehydrated, then it can actually take out extra water so you don't lose it. But if you're really hydrated, then you might have more of a moist poop, basically, to say. And you've probably all experienced it. If you're dehydrated, your poop is somewhat harder as well. Or if you're well hydrated, and this is the way to decrease constipation, right, is to drink a lot of fluid. If you're constipated, often they'll basically say drink a lot of fluid. And that helps. But also, let's say somebody has stomach cancer, or they had surgery, or a car accident, or something really bad happened, and they can't drink food, or maybe they had throat surgery. It can actually give nutrients through the large intestine. And so that's interesting, too. And you've probably heard about medications that are given by an enema. So an enema, basically, to deliver medications, because if you took it by mouth, it might be destroyed in the stomach by that acidic environment. So you can actually deliver medications in really needed aspects to the body by actually giving an enema in the large intestine. And that can then be absorbed into the bloodstream. So it's interesting to know how these different regions work, like for healthcare as well. Okay, vitamins. Oof, so many vitamins. How many do we have to memorize? Not that many. So the main thing is what we just talked about, intrinsic factor with B complex, particularly like B12, in related to anemia, right? Because you need the B12. So this is why alcoholics sometimes can be anemic. Other vitamins, really important. But look at the food products, where they come from. You know, citric fruit, right? Like oranges and lemons and limes. B12, different kinds of things like fish and eggs that you might have. And you think folic acid, very important. If you're prenatal care, for example, they tell you to have folic acid, right? Because of the closing of the spinal tract, basically, and then related with problems if you don't have folic acid and the nervous system development of a fetus, for example. So prenatal care with vitamins is really important for developmental reasons. But again, from meats and other products, you see a lot of these from whole grains. Again, milk products, eggs, lean meat. So what is the point here? If you're a strict vegetarian, what happens? You might not be getting the amino acids that you need. You might not be getting the vitamins that you need. So if you're a really strict vegetarian, for example, you have to watch out to make sure you eat the right amino acids. And so you can take supplements. And actually, if you don't eat the meats, you might not get the B complexes as well. So what do you want to do? Be very careful. So this is why some people actually take supplements if your diet is different, like a strict vegetarian. There's different levels of, that you know of a vegetarian, some that are will eat eggs or milk, and others no animal products whatsoever. So that's kind of interesting too, because you have to watch out for dietary deficiencies. In case you eat cereal, or you are a strict vegetarian, for example, or anybody that is, and you just eat your cereal, guess what's in your cereal? Insects. Insects are in your cereal. Actually, they allow so many insects to be found in food products like cereals and bread. And if they actually look through there, you will find cuticle or you'll find insect eyes and things like that. They grind it all up, but they can't keep it all out, right? Because it's harvested from the field, right? So insects are in there. They've actually looked at the water supply in New York, for example, and found out there's cocoa pods in the water. And they let it go because it actually helps clean the water. But some people, for religious reasons, don't want to eat crustaceans, but they're actually drinking them all the time. So it's kind of interesting as well. So a lot of things we don't think about. Some gals might be using lipstick, or people, I should say, now, might be using lipstick, for example, but what makes that red color on lipstick? Anybody know? They actually sell the different lipsticks in different ways, some of them without animal products, but it's actually ground up ladybug cuticle, right? The ladybug cuticle that looks red, that gives you that red color on the red lipstick. Isn't that wild? And so then you lick your lips and you're actually eating insects. All right, so it's kind of interesting to think about lots of different things with people think about what they're not eating, but what they really are eating. Okay, so watch out for these. And then think about, where did I want to go to with this? There's something I wanted to go to. Oh, yeah. These different enzymes, these different vitamins come from your diet, but also from the bacteria that's in your GI tract, right? We don't make these vitamins. That's why they're vitamins, right? We have to supplement them. We have to get them from our diet, or the bacteria in your GI tract has to make them. Some animals can actually make, like vitamin K or B complexes. We can't, so we have to get them in our supplement. So what happens if somebody, and this is, you know, a problem, you have an infection, for example, you take antibiotics. What do the antibiotics do? They kill the bacteria, right? But the bacteria in your gut is making these antibiotics and helping you digest your food. So if you take too high of an antibiotic, what's going to happen to the bacteria in your gut? Kills it out, right? And then you kill that out, you're not making the vitamins, but you're also not digesting your food. So what's called is sterilizing someone's gut, for example. Could be very bad, could be life-threatening. So some people that don't regulate their antibiotics, or they buy them in some countries, you can just go and buy them off the shelf. They're not regulated with a prescription. And they sterilize their gut, and then they die from it. So it's really important. Or some people are very susceptible to the antibiotics because they haven't taken them. And all of a sudden, here comes an old person that has an infection, for example, and they take the antibiotics, maybe their daughter's or son's antibiotics, and they take it themselves, thinking it's okay because it's going to kill out whatever they have. And then they sterilize their gut because they're more susceptible to the antibiotic, and then they end up in problems again. So think about these vitamins. We don't make them all. We're not a perfect animal. And then other animals actually make vitamins that they don't need in their digestion process. And you probably heard of the old stories, right? When the settlers came over from England, they called them the British. What did they call them? What's that term? The Redcoats. Huh? The Redcoats. No, the Limeys. Why did they call them the Limeys? Because they put limes on their boat because they needed the vitamin C. They were getting scurvy. They weren't getting the vitamin C on those long ship voyages. And so they were having vitamin C deficiency, so they realized they had to pack limes, and so they called them Limeys as a nickname because they had to package the limes. All right, so that's kind of interesting. Okay, let's go over a few of this gee-whizzy fun stuff and some things that I didn't get to. One thing I want to make sure that we get to that I didn't cover in the renal system, I don't think, was glomerular filtration rate, or clearance, also referred to as clearance. All right. So how to remember clearance. And this is important. This is a good index. So I want you to remember this because you might see it again. Clearance, or GFR, glomerular filtration rate, you can think of this as how well your kidneys function. So people measure this, and it's an interesting way. And how do you measure it? You measure the urine concentration of a compound, you measure the urine flow, and you measure the plasma concentration. What's another way to memorize this, maybe for you, that might appear on standardized exams? Think of GFR as clearance. So let's say clearance is C, right? I know this might be corny, but you know, think of C like cancer, right? Cancer. Where do you get skin cancer from? The sun. UV radiation. So C equals UV radiation, right? Skin cancer. Right? But how do you divide it? How do you protect yourself from skin cancer? Use protection. So you can divide that UV and knock it down by dividing it by P, right? Protection. So maybe that'll help you. C equals UV over P, right? So that might help you remember this equation. So C, cancer, equals UV divided by protection. I know it's corny, but now you won't forget it. You get it on a standardized exam or a final, then you're going to be able to solve that problem. All right? Okay. So when people have hemodialysis, for example, and get rid of excess waste, there's this weird phenomenon that they have this massive fatigue, and people are still trying to figure out why it is. Is it like you could have an abdominal dialysis, or they might do other ways, like through the blood, but they might just put something in the stomach and actually pull out excess water, or in your abdomen, in your abdomen, in the extracellular space and get out excess fluid, for example, or they might actually have hemodialysis and have your blood going through a dialysis machine. But these people are really wiped out, and they're trying to figure out why are they so wiped out. Is it just really the salt drop? Is it glucose drop? What is it? And they really haven't figured it out to figure and get these people back functioning again after dialysis. So it's really quite interesting, and more studies have to be done on these kind of aspects. Let me go to some little PowerPoints I was going to bring up along with what we just talked about. You can actually look up other aspects. Remember on Wikipedia, if you get something and we're going too fast, do a Wikipedia search quickly, right? Some of these things are really quite neat, but always, you know, kind of caution where it comes from. We talked about ruminant animals, if you need to know more about that, right? And the digestive processes. We don't really have digestion going on in the front stomach, but in the back stomachs. Okay, and then you think about hindgut fermentation. We've talked about fermentation even in us. The bacteria that's in our GI tract, we can keep that culture going because it stays pretty much in your large intestine, too, and that can re-inoculate your your intestine flora. You've probably heard of enemas that are actually poop enemas from other people, like after they sterilize their gut, for example, or whatever reason they had to get rid of that bacteria in their gut, or they're not, that's not the right bacteria, for example, they can take an enema, a poop enema from somebody else that has normal poop, and put that into them and re-inoculate their GI tract. I know that sounds gross, but they've now related that bacteria related to your ability to break down food substances. And it's actually related with maybe obesity as well, the different types of bacteria that's in your tract. You've probably seen the mice experiments that were done where they took the large mouse and the kind of a skinnier mouse, so the same genetic makeup, but they have different bacteria in their GI tract. They take the poop from the smaller mouse that's not obese, and they actually put it into inoculate the larger mouse, and it starts to lose weight. Wow. There's something that's really interesting about that. So there's some interesting aspects. And now, you know, as we mentioned, the immune system. So pretty interesting. When you think about it, when you're born, where does your bacteria come from? Your mother. Where from your mother? From the birth canal, right? But what if you had a C-section? You weren't exposed to that bacteria, right? And so what's the first bacteria the baby, the infant's exposed to? If they're breastfeeding, it'll be exposed to the bacteria that's on the skin, right? Which is commonly staph. So now you've just inoculated the GI tract of that baby with staph instead of the flora that's in the vaginal tract, right? The birth tract. So some people actually advocated for C-sections to actually take a vaginal swab and actually inoculate the infant that's born to give them the natural flora. So that was kind of back and forth, and now they're still questionable because they've seen it different ways doing this to infants and found out after 6 months it really didn't matter. They got the natural flora to actually go on. But if they're a preemie, for example, or they don't have this exposure and they're in a neonatal isolation, where are they getting this bacteria to start breaking down the food products, right? So it's really quite interesting concept. There's some debates out there about C-sections are natural birth for lots of reasons, and then also the bacteria that inoculates the GI tract. So some of these, you can actually Google this and you can find out about this. There's controversy out there too, but some people actually advocate for this and others don't. And then they basically have done studies to show the differences and found out about 6 months it didn't matter, but it might in those earlier months that are very critical for an infant as well for digesting food right. So lots of things to think about in the digestive processes and that bacteria that gets into your, helps you for digestion. All right, so we are going to maybe not get through all of this kind of fun chapter, but I posted all these PowerPoints in the system, but we do want to go through it. It's not that much. It's about 15 minutes worth. And then we're going to have review on Tuesday, right? So if you have questions over the weekend, go through old exams. Come with your questions on Tuesday, and we'll continue going. But while we're talking about digestion and breaking down products, and you had the respiratory lab, you can actually measure the amount of CO2 and oxygen consumption with a mask, and you can pretty much estimate the type of food that's being digested. So this is called the RQ respiratory quotient. Respiratory quotient. And don't confuse this equation. The measurements, CO2 over oxygen, CO2 produced over oxygen consumption. So you can measure the CO2 produced and you measure the oxygen consumption. And if you look at the byproducts here, we know C6H12O6 plus 6 oxygens, right, equals 6 waters and 6 CO2s. You got that tattoo down? So what do you get then? A respiratory quotient of 1, right? Because you use 6 oxygens and you produce 6 CO2s. But if you have the respiratory quotient that's less than 1, then you know you're breaking down other aspects besides just the carbohydrates. All right, so that's the take-home of that. And you can actually do it like they do with the cow on the North Campus. You can put food in there, and you can actually see their CO2 production, so you can actually measure that and understand that that's starting to break down the products and getting the metabolism. So you can measure cellular metabolism, but you also measure the metabolism of the food that they're eating. And like we've talked about before, specific mass to metabolic rate, the mouse to elephant curve for homeotherms, just that you see that again and kind of remember this. And then you think about metabolic rate with mass, even in invertebrates, this can be an issue if they're moving at our metabolic rate for that animal size. Movements, this is kind of like I said, gee whizzy, but it kind of makes you think about the energy needs for animals. If it's a large animal, they can, it takes them a while to move, but then to stop moving, right, are the time of the energy needed to get going for a large animal. The inertia is quite a bit more, right? But they might be able to not be able to maintain it as well. So all this is the idea of how these size of the animal, environment, nutrient needs, kind of the common sense aspects that we could think about. All right. And then you think about all these ideas to measure metabolism, and we'll stop here. You know, the mice on a running wheel, for example, you could measure their pattern, our circadian patterns, but that's going to relate with digestion, right? And so people have measured circadian patterns in humans, right? And you know your metabolism rate, your hormones released. And the problems if you're a night shift worker, why do they pay night shift workers more money? Why do they pay night shift workers more money? There's actually cases in England that these night shift workers sued the government and then got more money. And then that started the trend worldwide pretty much about night shifts being compensated more. Why? Night shift workers have more problems, right? They've actually indicated more stress problems, more digestive problems, more cancer problems, a lot of problems because they're not on their normal cycle. And then you think about the dietary problems. If it's not on that normal cycle with your hormones and your eating, you can really think of a lot of issues with that. So this is one reason why night workers are paid a different compensation, not just because they're away from family or things, because of health risks. All right, let's stop here. We will do about 10 more minutes of this on Tuesday. Review for the rest of Tuesday. Go through all the exams this weekend. It's going to rain anyway. Spend the time indoors. Study, study, study. If you haven't picked up your old test, come on up here. Did you get yours?
Yeah, I already did. I was like, cancer, what?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.